Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. A revised version of a riot-boosting bill passed in the State House of Representatives Tuesday. Representative John Hansen of Del Rapids is the prime sponsor of that bill, which now heads to the Senate. In the process of working out the state budget, how do the parties want to allocate South Dakota revenues? There's a lot happening in the state capitol this week, so we've placed calls to our Dakota political junkies for their appraisal. John Hunter is publisher of the Madison Daily Leader, and he's joining us by phone in Madison. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon, Lori. Thanks for asking.
And Jonathan Ellis is with the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. He's on the line in Sioux Falls as well. Welcome back, Jonathan.
Thank you. And I'm not going to be boosting any riots on the show today.
No boosting, please. Thank you. We're going to keep everything very civil and calm here. But it brings up this really great question as we've kind of, you know, this is in the lexicon now where we just say riot boosting. This was something that came up last year, was deemed unconstitutional. This is the second try at it. Jonathan, can you explain what this legislation is really trying to get to at its heart? What is riot boosting?
I'm not sure I can exactly. I mean, they're trying. So basically, this is some preemptive legislation that that the governor sponsored last year with the thought that someday there's going to be this Trans-Canada pipeline that's going to be built, and we'll see some protests of that. And the original legislation, you know, made it a crime for if you were inciting people to riot, and there was property damage or violence, that the government could then go after you. So that passed, and of course it was controversial because it was introduced very late in the session. There was very little debate. It gets ramrodded through, and then on to inevitable court challenge. Parts of it struck down as unconstitutional, and now we have this second effort, which repeals, I think, some of the language that was struck down. And if you look at the bill as it's been amended and it passed through the House yesterday, that, you know, it tries to focus on violent acts. And so I think that the supporters of the legislation now are hopeful that it passes muster, First Amendment muster, because it focuses on, you know, inciting violence. You have disagreement, however, from the ACLU that this is just more of an infringement upon the First Amendment. We already have existing laws in place throughout the country, and so you have again another deep division about what the intent here is with regard to what we expect someday this pipeline to be built.
John Hunter, is inciting an act of violence already illegal, and if so, how does this bill propose to do anything different?
Well, it's. I'm glad you asked the first question of Jonathan, because it is a hard one to answer. I think the original intent, and there's a myriad of different sides of this one, was to try to find someone or try to find many people to somehow take financial responsibility for whatever happens. And so they're trying to extend. So let's pretend person A comes and does substantial property damage on someone. They wanted not only have that person be responsible, but for the someone else who said, hey, go set that thing on fire in protest. And so they're trying to say that, you know, there's other people, and even if they're far away, if they encouraged or pushed people to have this property damage or violence, that they should both be responsible for that. And so, but it, again, I'm a defender of the First Amendment and the freedom of Americans to protest peaceably, and freedom of speech. I think I've been very strong in my defense of those. But as Jonathan said, that it's a preemptive thing. They're trying to kind of legislate something before it happens and prevent this thing. So it is very complicated. I don't know if this version still will make it through the courts. That's the intent of the sponsors, but I would guess it would be challenged again, and we'll see if it passes. I mean, it's only gone through the House. It has a ways to go.
Right. And on that vein, Representative Tim Goodwin said that he would rather pay, and I'm quoting from an Argus Leader story by Lisa Caskey, that he would rather pay $180,000 in a lawsuit over the bill than $35 million in protest damages. And Jonathan, I feel like we should have a lawmaker quotation of the week, because this one is really worth unpacking. Like, I'd rather pay the lawsuit than these damages, which gets to the heart of not only why is this bill being addressed, is the fear of what happened in North Dakota happening here in South Dakota. But is that a logic that goes very far in the State House, do you think, Jonathan?
Well, yeah, I think among some, certainly among Representative Goodwin's colleagues, I think that that logic would go far. I mean, if they honestly believe that, you know, there's going to be mass protests, and the North Dakota one, correct? It wasn't a Keystone. What was the name of that pipeline?
Right. Dakota Access Pipeline.
But I mean the thought that there is going to be this national, I mean this was a national, maybe even international protest, you know, that brought protesters from all over the country, and there was a lot of damage and pollution and all that. I mean, so I think that when members of the state legislature look at what happened in that situation, and then with the prospect of this Keystone Pipeline coming through the state, and this Keystone Pipeline is like a symbol of epic proportions, I think that they probably do see that this could be something that a worthwhile investment of some legal fees, and certainly there will be if this does go through and get all the way to the governor's desk, which she would presumably sign. Certainly, we will back in court again to find out if these changes, still stand up.
Yeah, and John Hunter, that he brings up a point here that's worth, you can see as lawmakers and peer are talking about that this pipeline symbolizes something that's a heck of a lot more than a pipeline, including race and climate change and political party. And you can see Republicans and Democrats and peer, voting on party lines pretty strictly on this.
Absolutely, and you're right, Laurie, and there may be even some that we haven't mentioned there, but
right.
It has to do with climate change, it has to do with alternative energy, it has to do with economics, either here or in the Gulf.
It has to do with Obama and Trump, yeah, it has to do with presidential election, yeah.
Absolutely, so how do you sort those people out then? It seems as though some people at least come into that conversation with their minds made up based on one of those other factors, regardless of what this particular thing is. It's hard to have debates and to craft legislation when people have essentially decided how they feel about an issue before it gets introduced, and based on factors that aren't going to be discussed here.
Right. And Victoria Wicks, in her reporting on this, mentioned that Speaker of the House, Stephen Haugaard, was a Republican who said, no, not yet. This isn't there yet. So there are outliers. I think that's important to note as well. I want to shift a little bit, but stay on the First Amendment and talk about the story that Jonathan wrote for the Argus Leader about a social media censorship bill, and it's a sort of quick and undignified demise. But tell us a little bit about this legislation, Jonathan, and what the debate tells us, again, about broader conversations in our society right now.
Well, the sponsor, Jeff Monroe of Pure, had brought a bill that would have allowed users of social media platforms who had content censored to sue those social media companies. They had to have, I guess, 75 million users or more. So basically, we're looking at the big ones like Facebook and Twitter and maybe Instagram. But the bill died quickly. There was really no debate about it at all. But it does, I think, get to the point that there are conservatives who are concerned that these giant social media platforms have been censoring speech, and that these private businesses are becoming so powerful that they're almost sort of quasi-governmental in a way in which they can control speech. So there is this concern. Obviously, we should know that the First Amendment only applies to the government, and I think this is an attempt by Senator Monroe to apply the First Amendment to some big social media companies that are involved in communication.
Yeah. Jonathan, any thoughts about this as it ties into broader social conversations right now? People are upset and asking questions. Maybe we're thinking about the First Amendment in ways that we haven't in quite some time because of some of these challenges.
Well, yeah, and I think that's definitely true. And like John, I'm pretty much a First Amendment absolutist. Nowadays, anybody on a social media account with a significant number of followers can kind of say whatever they want. And, you know, that has not always been the case, obviously. There were in our industry sort of gatekeepers about what would be permitted on a letter to the editor, for example, so that you wouldn't necessarily get, crazy stuff written about. I mean, I listen to some tinfoil hat legislation today. Okay, I mean, some of this stuff just comes out. So there has been definitely a change in what we talk about, how we talk about it, because of social media, and then of course the concerns that these social media companies are going to subjectively decide what they consider to be hate speech, for example. If you were to go and ask somebody on the far left or far right what they consider hate speech, we would probably have different definitions of that.
Right. Tinfoil hat legislation. Nice one. John Hunter, anything you want to weigh in on social media and, really disinformation and just how this is sort of affecting our daily lives?
Yeah, I do. Thanks. I think we need to understand that there are actually some people who really oppose the First Amendment, and that seems hard to imagine.
Right.
Where you'd say we shouldn't have freedom of speech, and that's, in some senses, it's a growing movement. It would be startling to most Americans over the last 240 years that have counted on that and differentiated America by allowing people to speak freely. But there are a lot of people, and again, I say you shouldn't be able to speak about this or that or so forth. And actually, there are a fair number of college students. You'd be surprised, I think, that young people are saying, no, you should censor us. You should not allow. I mean, I've heard that comment. We're on college campuses. We should not be allowed to speak freely. And I'm surprised that people want to give up that right. But clearly with the social media companies, remember, these are unmonitored, as Jonathan was requiring. If you write a letter to the editor of a newspaper, we would exclude things that would be illegal or, include certain things, profanity and so forth, that might not be appropriate for a general audience. But these social media companies, they don't go through that process. And everyone who is criticized then thinks that the social media company should take out the criticism of that, whether it's left or right or whatever that is. So, yeah, I think really freedom of speech as we know it is up for debate.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the state budget. And as we hit the halfway mark in the South Dakota State Legislature, it's time to really turn up the volume on that a little bit. And again, we're seeing, John Hunter, let's start with you, some real party division and people really saying it matters that the Republicans are in charge. You want more Democrats. You want fewer Democrats. It's definitely a political conversation already.
It is. There are all sorts of. What I find interesting, really, Lori, is that you'll hear Cracker Barrel kind of discussions, and that's, I think, in many cases where the rubber meets the road. Right? These are our people from our district or districts across the state meeting with their constituents, their neighbors, and so forth. And those are fairly common of kind of a unified message of being able to try to find money for teacher salaries and those kind of things. And you get to actual votes in the appropriation committee, and then on the floor it gets harder because then you get specific, and if you have a limited pool of money, then how do you choose between A and B? And back in the Cracker Barrel, you said, I like both A and B. But right. Then eventually when you get to peer, you sometimes have to decide. So it gets very difficult. South Dakota, in a lot of cases, has been conservative in its revenue forecasts. And then we get to this mid-session revision of that, and it often, I don't, I haven't kept track of it, but it often will show a little bit better than what we thought. So from the governor's budget address in December until mid-February, we have a chance. We usually have a little bit more money, and we're able to satisfy some of those things.
Yeah, Jonathan, when I first went to Pierre, you know, the early talk, governor's state of the state address, the Republican leadership in the state legislature, the Democratic leadership in the state legislature, all said the same thing, and that's that we want to fund those inflationary pay increases for teachers, state employees, and service care providers. We just have to figure out how to do it. But money's tight. Do you think that that's still driving the ship in Pierre when it comes to appropriation?
I do. I think that is a priority for a lot of lawmakers, especially those lawmakers on appropriations. You've seen now revenue forecasts that are a little better than what were initially proposed by the governor. You know, the fight always comes down to, it's not unusual for the legislature to want to pick a rosier revenue forecast than the governor. That's actually, that happens all the time. And so the fight will be between, I think, the governor, potentially this is where the fight will be at the end of the day on the budget, will be between the governor and maybe some lawmakers who want to go ahead and have a rosier projection than the governor's office is maybe comfortable with. You know, in terms of the politics of it, of course, this is the politics. I mean, I think the complaints that you see from some Democrats, I think they've probably complained about education funding in every legislature since 1890, so this is nothing new. They complain that Republicans are a little too parsimonious with the budget, and they, you know, put forward proposals. And they do this frequently to maybe use some one-time funding from like state trust funds to prop up some spending. That's a fairly common. That's something that they propose. I want to say almost every year to get into trust funds. They think that the state has held on to those too closely. So. Now, these ideas will take them to the voters in this upcoming election, and they've done this every year I've ever covered the legislature.
Right. And to be fair, you know, we say they've complained about education, and they would say, we've advocated for education every year, and people should pay attention to that. Why is it up to us? And if that's the only group that's going to do it, I mean, Jamie Smith was talking largely about that in some of his press conferences of being pretty vocal about their advocacy for education and using it as an opportunity to say, pay attention who you vote for. I want to talk about, John Hunter, your editorial in the Madison Daily Leader about buffer strips. And I think everybody knows what a buffer strip is, but tell us a little bit about how they're impacting our lives now, especially as we head into spring flooding season, and why you chose this as a topic to bring attention to right now?
Well, there's a couple different things why it's timely now. One, as you're aware, these buffer strips are intended to be next to creeks and streams and lakes and so on to somehow grab excess nutrients and sediment from fields and cities and so forth. So the idea is you'd plant grasses along each side of a creek, and then as the rain comes and the snow melts, then whatever excess nitrogen and phosphorus are then used by these grasses, they don't make it into the waterways, which then would help reduce algae blooms and so forth. But sediment is also a part of that too. So erosion, you think of farm field erosion or city erosion, and these grassy strips, and they can vary in width, how far away from the water you get. But they capture sediment as well, and sediment is getting to be a bigger problem in South Dakota lakes and streams than it has been. And part of that is the increased flow in a lot of rivers and streams, primarily due to tiling, so that the rivers, which in a lot of cases, here we are in February of 2020, are full and running and have a lot of sediment in those. As sediment builds up in lakes and streams, or mostly in creeks and streams, then it reduces the capacity. So as water comes through during a heavy rain event or something, it's more likely to flood. Now in Madison, we're scrambling right now in preparation for melting in a few weeks. to clean out these creeks of sediment so that the creeks can handle the capacity that needs to and doesn't flood and destroy people's homes and so on. So South Dakota a few years ago put in a voluntary buffer strip legislation that gives a small property tax break for those people who do that. Not many people have applied for that. Now, there may be some people who are planting grassy strips without, or buffer strips, without applying to the program for the discount on property taxes. Our neighbor in Minnesota has made it mandatory, which certainly is not kind of South Dakota style to make that kind of stuff mandatory. But they've had preliminary compliance of very strong there, even though not, people don't always agree with it. So I'm thinking that in South Dakota, we may not want to go to the mandatory level, but I think we should increase our incentives to try to plant these, get the economic development, the economic benefits and the ecological benefits of these grassy strips for not a lot of extra money. I think it'd be prudent for us to do that.
You say 99% of land, the compliance in Minnesota, 99% adjacent to lakes and streams, and 95% of all bodies of water in South Dakota, it's more like 40%.
Right.
Reported 40%, yeah.
Yeah, that's a big deal. It really does matter. I don't think there's any dispute about the science of buffer strips.
Right. So why not make it mandatory then?
Well, because not everyone believes South Dakota, which, as you may know, is very strong on individual property ownership rights. Like, if I have this land, I should be able to do with it.
Right. It will die a swift death in the legislature, like the social media bill did. Is that what you're saying?
Well, so yeah. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Yeah. You know, I was going to say, Lori, if you still have a second, I don't want to run out of time, but this is a great, very interesting topic, and John is right. I would say that if there's not a solution found, I mean, if they don't come up with a solution, okay, if this voluntary program isn't working, as John says that in his editorial, that we need to find more, you know, boost the incentive for this to work. Here's what's going to happen. It's a problem. Water quality is a problem, okay? And if it isn't dealt with here, isn't dealt with by our legislature, I can tell you that eventually it's going to be dealt with on a national level, okay? And you already have national environmental groups who are wanting federal legislation. So it's in landowners' best interest now to deal with this now, or else it's probably the regulation is just going to get worse.
Yeah, and to do that, you might need that incentive. Or that might be one way to think about, use the incentive, everybody rally behind the incentive, let's go solve the problem, because the problem needs to be solved.
It is a growing problem.
Yeah.
And you think of Minnesota, remember that with the land of 10,000 lakes or whatever, that they believe...
or whatever.
or, yeah, say 15,000.
It's like a super South Dakota thing to say.
Every puddle.
So go ahead.
I think... generally have been more protective of those lakes. I mean, because I think it's been a bigger part of who they are. And, and so the lakes in the Glacial Lakes region have a lot of nitrogen and phosphorus in them, a lot of algae blooms. And is that something we want to fix, or is that something we want to continue or get worse? Those are decisions for both voters and legislators.
Fascinating stuff. John Hunter, Jonathan Ellis, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lori.
Thank you.